very much for coming and making it out on the last Thursday of term. It's been a slog. You've all been working really hard, but we thought we're going to end it with something a little bit more kind of creative and open and lively than your usual kind of academic paper. So that's your reward for making it this far, right? And also in service of something that I think we've all been wanting to do for a while, which is make sure that, you know, the stuff that we're giving in the African Studies seminar connects a lot more with creative arts and literature and people who are working in creative and as to represent Africa, rather than always kind of in an academic framing. So I just wanted to introduce, Olamide Popola is going to talk about her book, When We Speak of Nothing. I can't forget. Books by Olamide and also by Cassava Republic, other writers, are for sale, right, at the front, and she's very happy to sign copies of her book for you as well. I was going to do some bio details to introduce the speakers, and one of the first things I found out about Olamide is that there's another Olamide Popola.
Really?
Who's Googleable, who is a forensic linguist at Aston University, and who's actually a guy. And given kind of like the book that we're going into, I thought that was incredibly fitting, actually. So if you've read the book, you'll know why I think that, and if you haven't, you should find out. Olamide, this is your fourth book. So you've written another novel, a collection of stories, and a play as well, right? Mm-hmm. And you were brought up in Germany originally, and then Nigeria, and you're now based in Brighton?
London.
In London, okay, right, sorry. And this is a really interesting book for me, and I know David Pratton has been really interested to hear about it as well, and has read it already, in fact, because his kind of Arts of Oil in Port Harcourt thing is very pertinent in this book as well. I was really kind of conflicted about how much to kind of tell you about the book, because I kind of give away how it unfolds if I tell you about it. But what can I say? It's a tale of two cities. It's set in the London riots. It's also set in Port Harcourt in the middle of the kind of people exploring kind of oil and oppression within the context of oil. And coming of age is such a corny thing to call a book. It's a book about teenagers coming to terms with identity, national identity, personal identity, family identity, gender identity. So it's a really... It's a complex book and a really interesting book. And it's also, unlike a lot of books that bring out things like that, has a plot. That is really good. Because sometimes you feel like you've been given like very wholesome things to eat that are not actually fun. But this is a book that carries you through and it has pace and it has style.
Thank you.
So what we're going to do is one of those kind of in-conversation things. I'm going to sort of put a few questions. We're going to hear some readings. I'm going to talk to Bibi a little bit and introduce her and talk about Cassava Republic, and then let's open it out after that. So, Olamide, if you'd like to begin by giving us a taste of the book.
Great, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for coming out on such a rainy evening. I'll just read from the beginning of the novel, which introduces the two main characters, Carl and Abu, and because it's the beginning, you would be able to follow very easily. It is easy to be outnumbered when you are lost in your tracks. Keep close to the source. If not for Abu flicking his head back every so often, waiting a split sec, full on profile, to make sure Carl was keeping track, it would have been impossible to tell them apart. Those two, like twins. The funny thing, Abu's parents already had twins, and they were sweet but annoying 7 years old. It was almost as if Abu had needed to find his own match, so he had someone to leave the house with. Even funnier, his mother, and later the dad, accepted Carl as the brother from another mother, meaning Carl was in and out of the house like trains out of St. Pancras station. More in than out, actually. And to bring that funny ha-ha, what a coincidence thing home, they even looked alike. Carl's face a tad longer, shoulders narrower, hair cropped, eyes much more dreamy, but both their lips full in a different way, but still, if you'd thought about it, you'd say the works. You'd say, dang. Those are some alike-looking teenagers. Their friendship must have rubbed onto their buddies, accepting that they were a pair in tandem, teamwork. That day, the way that white stuff poured from the sky had made them go out. Not that that was rare or anything, and they slid and slipped across the streets, trying to chase each other, snowballs buzzing. The way drizzled down, now that was movie classic. It was all very, ha-ha, so much fun, yeah, day four, but too cold, what gwan with this season, get this one, bruv, and bang. A whole load straight into the face. Then, out of nowhere, three wannabe guys they knew from sixth form jumping them right at the corner to Lee Street. Like real jump. Two of them at Abu calling him Abu ka ha 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 pussy and other things that shouldn't be said in front of anyone. Twisting his arm back in its socket like you just got the GCSEs in bullying. It was crunching. Abu whined. Carl, that one, so immaculate. It was troubling. Abu even had a little fit earlier that evening because Carl had been doing his usual must look pretty thing. Without words, obviously. Iron denim wasn't enough. It all had to be prepped properly and color-coded until it was just so. Spending a lot of time in the bathroom, blocking it for the rest of the family. Then a very light gray pair of jeans, which had made no sense, unless he wanted to match the weather. They were bound to get dirty in the snow. When the boy slammed Carl into the fence, the black paint peeled off the metal straight onto the nice, nicely ironed, not good for the season denim. It was really shit. And hopefully Carl was thinking of the stain rather than staying in the moment, breath and all. Hopefully instead, he was lamenting this unnecessary affront against his style. You know that type is serious for real. Because the guy, the one holding him, went straight for the soft parts. Carl didn't say a word. No sound left his lips. His upper body folded over as much as it could, as much as the guy would let him. Abu wasn't as quiet. When is he ever? He was talking away, cursing and shouting and fucking this and fucking that, but the snow swallowed it all as if it had been planned. This country's not equipped? Ha! The one time everything is out of action and the snow makes everyone feel all Christmassy, and you know that spells giddy and means silly. Effing miracles can happen. Imagine. Abu cursing louder and more, his voice always over the top because he wants to make up for something. Someone said that. That he wants to show the world something, but actually, the world couldn't give anything at all about what Abu has to prove. And of course, that doesn't stop him. It's not about someone hearing him. It's about him expressing, saying, or shouting. Like now, shouting because he's scared. For Carl. And I'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
So since you started out with the two main characters, I wanted to ask you, like, reading this book, reading these characters and their friends, you know, they're 17, 18, 19 in the book. They come across, the way you write them, as this funny mix of incredibly kind of old beyond their years and wise and hardened and also really, really sensitive and vulnerable. And is that kind of like how you see kids of that age growing up in London today? And I'm curious, that's part A of the question, and part B is like, kind of, how did you research these characters? Kind of, who are they from? Where are they from?
It's interesting. I think you're quite right. I didn't think about how they're much older than their actual years, but I think one thing, if you grow up in London, you have to be street smart sometimes, especially if you live in, you know, the urban setting. And also the reality of their lives in a way. Carl's situation, and there's many parts to that, his family situation, also, of course, he has to sort of grow up beyond his years very quickly anyway. And I guess Abu as his best friend sort of matches that and mirrors that and grows with him. I came about these characters because I worked in a youth center and a community center for a long time, and I had a, you know, had a big youth programs, and these young people were coming in and out, and I was quite fascinated how especially the young boys or young men were conducting themselves. They had these sort of rituals I wasn't familiar with, and sometimes it's just about how they shook hands and, you know, what the body language is like. And it was very fascinating, very endearing, because they were very, very loyal and very earnest, and that prompted me probably to make them very grown up in a way, because I felt just they knew what the right things were, how you had to act, how you had to, you know, keep a friendship going. And then what happened, obviously, we had what was first the credit crunch, and which then became the whole economic, you know, crisis that we had in Britain. So I wanted to sort of give these types of young men a voice to explore what's going on in the country, and that's how it started.
Thanks. So from a completely different angle,
yeah,
I'm just interested, like, so you sort of grew up in three countries, and I'm thinking in terms of your kind of, in terms of your reading background, like, what African writers did you encounter when you were maybe the age the characters are or were formative on you? And actually also, what kind of representations of Nigeria in literature?
I was an avid reader long, you know, that's in my whole teens. So who was around? There's a Ghanaian German poet was big, Maya Yin. That was one of my big influences. So it's maybe not the type of answer you're looking for. Obviously, I read some of the classics, the Chinua Achebes and stuff. But I was very much drawn to African-American writers as well, especially women writers. So I think that those were the ones that formed me mostly, I think, at that time. But there were more local African German writers that influenced me a lot, and one of them, the biggest one, is Maya Yim. I think, yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm interested. So, and Maya Yim is a poet.
She's a poet. She's not alive anymore, but yeah, she's a poet. Yeah.
So, do you read a lot of poetry? Because it's interesting reading the book, right? It's a lot. It has a rhythm to it. It has a love of language, and it's not just about kind of, you know, it goes beyond. It's a very aesthetic book, isn't it?
I come from poetry, and I did poetry and spoken word for a long time, 15 years, and that's sort of how I established myself in Germany, and in, you know, especially in the sort of black literature or African literature scene in Germany. And I came to a point where I couldn't find the next level in a way. I couldn't find a new voice as a poet, and that's when I pursued longer sort of form and fiction, and that's how I arrived writing novels. And I'm still in that dilemma. If I could find a different way of writing poems, I would probably also write poems, but right now it's the novel, really. But of course, that has influenced me a lot, and you can see that, I think, in most of my writing. That is very much about the melody has to be right, the rhythm has to be right. So I'm glad you mentioned plot, so I managed to also bring the plot in, but I'm very language-driven. And it has to sort of be nice for me to read, because I'm so much, that's what I did for a long time, as spoken word artist. So I was presenting my work orally.
Spoken word in English or German?
Both.
So, I'm really interested, why Port Harcourt? You know, a lot of people maybe London and Lagos, but why is yours London, Port Harcourt?
I wanted to specifically find out about the Niger Delta. So I created a story, and I felt, created a story that allowed me to go to the Niger Delta. And Port Harcourt, it might have been a logistic. I don't know how it came about, because I wanted to go specifically to the Bomi pipeline, which is one, the first one that went live. That was really big. So it was logistics around that, wanting to find out what the devastation is like, the ecocide in the Niger Delta, and then also accessibility, what my contacts were for research.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean the kind of activist characters that are in this book are kind of people that spring from life that you met?
Yeah, it's not modeled on anyone at all, but I did have an activist who took me around, who I had a very strong bond with for a short time that we worked together, and that I was in contact for a couple of years afterwards quite regularly. So I don't know if initially I had such a big idea of having such a central activist figure in there, but he was a very moving guy. So yeah, certain things that came out of that encounter with this guy, especially the whole Ken Saro-Wiwa anger, because this activist was completely obsessed with Ken Saro-Wiwa, understandably. And
I also observed, talking about the issues that are in the book, mm-hmm. was really gratifying. You know, as academics, we're always being asked about impact and like mm-hmm. how has your work had an impact, and you specifically name check the UCL Legacies of British Slavery Project.
Which, there you go.
If you're kind of from a history and arts background, it's got to be really, really gratifying that this has now made it into a fictional representation. I mean, that's impact right there.
That's impact there, and it's so accidental, because it just happened while I was writing and I was working just around the corners. And, you know, so all of these things just sort of fell into place. The same with, so a lot of strands came about. The riots, there were not planned to be any riots in the book. Okay. And then the riots happened, and I was talking about young people, and I worked in the center, where one day I came into the center and there was a note for other young people where they were meeting that particular day. And I knew that I was slightly too old for that crowd, and I was sort of, or should I say something to a manager? And I just closed, you know, it was on the computer, I just closed it, and I thought, they'll do whatever they do, and that's their job. But so, you know, so the narrative evolves because of life, because life comes into it while you're writing.
I think maybe time for another reading.
All right. There's a reveal in this section, but I am not going to point you to it. So you will notice it or you won't notice it. And then when you read the book, hopefully you'll then know what I'm talking about. But by this time, Carl has gone to Nigeria to meet his father, and he is very smitten by this activist friend's cousin, Januma. And this is the first time they sort of find themselves alone. Carl stepped into the small shop. It was so dark, his eyes couldn't make out anything but contours and shapes. "Close the door, please. My aunt has already finished. I don't feel like dealing with any late customers." The enclosed space amplified the scratchy sound his red flip-flops produced on the painted cement floor. How much more aware of yourself could you be? "Really push it. It's stuck." Januma switched on a lamp opposite the entrance. It got all cozy. "Choose any material," she smiled. Carl nodded. The fabrics were divided in sections according to main colors. Rows all neat and efficient, using all the space from ceiling to floor. "You've done your hair," Carl said. "If I don't plait it, my parents complain. Then my mother wants me to get a weave. I don't want a weave. I didn't think it was long enough to get it done." "Oh, they can, as you can see." "Hmm," Carl mumbled. He had nothing to say. He just liked her face, liked it so much. The tight braids showed rows of scalp all neat and tidy, like the setup in the shop. Januma stood out against the backdrop of color. "You know, we don't really go to tailors in London," she laughed. "That's what we do here. We give material as presents. Just choose something. Your mother can use it on top of the bed." The skirt Januma wore was figure-hugging, as they said here, tied from waist to calves, flaring in pleats. The top was sleeveless and tailored in the UK sense. She fumbled in her handbag, then turned around again, CD in hand. "I burned some music, Afrobeat, the current pop music. Maybe you like the vibe." She laughed and made a step toward Carl. Carl's body switched on, head burning. "Did you bring your laptop, or do you want me to put it on your MP3? "My phone." The noise that came out of Carl's mouth, a frog's attempt to free itself from serious captivity. He was trying to get his hand to let go of the door handle, trying to leave this looking at her, instead touch the material, the fabric, which covered almost all surfaces, and allow it to cool his burning palms and the burning in his throat, the burning that just wouldn't leave since Januma had taken his hand a few days ago when they were sitting together in the taxi, the burning that had returned when she leaned on him at Nakale's party. "What is the problem? You're marrying that door. Try at least to look like you're choosing something." "Ha ha," he wanted to laugh. "Nothing wrong with a little affection for our functional items," he wanted to reply. "Something funny. Amuse her. Respond. Do anything at all." He felt unsteady as he stepped into the room. "You know," he started. "What?" Her face was starting to glow, the sweat. "You know," he tried to continue. "I do actually know quite a lot of things. That's why I'm studying." "So which thing are we talking about?" He smiled. She had to be that damn smart assery, didn't she? "You are. I am. That is true. Very philosophical. I hope that's not all of it." It didn't seem like she was still mocking him. More like a question. They were now facing each other. "You are. Fantastic sort of sense-making. Bravo, Carl. Real fucking brilliant. The what to do and when to place it. The how to undress and how much to leave underneath. The give someone all that could hurt oneself. All them. And then stand still. Just stand." And I'm going to leave it here, actually, because then it's nice and ambiguous.
Nice. Cool. Let's talk a little bit, we'll come back to the book, but let's talk a little bit about the publishing scene and what this fits within. So I want to introduce Bibi Bakar Yusuf, who's the founder of Kassabra Public Press, and she her own academic background is in philosophy, gender studies, and the body. That's her PhD from Warwick. And if you are familiar with Oyeronke Oyewumi's Invention of Women, but you might also be familiar with Bibi's critique of it called Yorubas Don't Do Gender. No question mark. It's not like you two allow ambiguity, which is a really interesting argument with that and the kind of like linguistics as prime kind of argument that's in it. I just want to know, and Bibi is also, among other things, and the chair of Initiative for Equal Rights, which is the biggest LGBTQ sort of, do we call it an NGO or a CSO, or what do we call it?
NGO.
In West Africa, I think, yeah. So do you want to tell us a little bit about kind of Cassava Republic and where that came from? I should also recognise the other power behind Cassava Republic, Emma Shercliffe, is at the back here, hiding, maybe. There you go.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. So Cassava Republic is a publishing house that we started. I started in about 12 years ago with Jeremy Witt in Abuja. And the idea for Cassava Republic is to get more books by African writers being published and available on the continent. It is also focused around trying to create a conversation on different ways of looking and seeing and thinking and interpreting Africa. That's number one reason. And number two is focused around my own personal interest in memory and archive and how we imagine the past in order to provoke the future. So Cassava Republic is really a project about what I call creating the African archival future. So the kinds of things we want to see in the archive in 500 years' time, we have to create it today. Hence why the kinds of books we publish. So Olumide is When We Speak of Nothing, She Called Me Woman, which is the first book about queer women in Nigeria. So I'm very much interested in curating a future in the present. So we want to produce materials for today, but really focusing on a long-term vision. And also, and that's number two. Number three, Cassava Republic is committed to owning the means of production. That it's not just about Africans writing the text, that the people behind the creation of the text, in terms of the dissemination, the production of it, it's important that Africans are owning that, because whoever sits behind the wheel is going to direct the kinds of stories that gets published. I strongly believe that if we allow only Western publishing corporation to determine African writing future, then we are going to be left with a whole generation I need to be careful because this is being recorded. So we're going to have a narrative that says where a Chimamanda, for example, will be the pinnacle of African success. We're going to have a narrative where Tomi Adeyemi, Children of Blood and Bones, are the stories we get to hear about. And they're as important as they are. We also need other kinds of voices that a Western machinery may not think is African enough. And I think that whatever Africans decide to write is what it's enough for them. So I'm very much publishing as Africans to own the means of production so that we don't reproduce what happened before the Achebian generation, where it was the African men of letters. A whole generation of African literature has been determined and configured based on those very foundational narrative of the so-called African father the Achebe and Nkobe being the African father of literature, which is not really the case. It's only African literature, father of African literature if you're coming from a particular perspective. That aside, so for me, it's important that we don't allow that to continue. And so I'm interested in not just Cassava Republic owning the means of production, that we also have more Africans publishing as well as writing. The writing stuff, if you ask people in the room, most there'll be people who are interested in writing, but very few people want to do publishing. And I feel that that's where the power lies, and I'm interested in power.
Okay, so in your quest for power and world domination, yeah,
yes.
You left a thing out of that, like political economy sort of value chain thing, I think. Sorry, can I grab some water? And that's kind of curation, right? Like a lot of people who encounter African literature either encounter it through, you know, what gets commercialized, but also through reading lists, through curricula.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think about the kind of roster of books that commonly make it onto kind of represent African writing on university curricula?
I think that the really good question. Thank you. I think part of curating the African archival future, the curriculum is very much inside there. We have to, part of decolonizing the curriculum is providing a variety of texts that people can choose from. And in doing so, we have part of our project, especially starting in Nigeria, is to get more Nigerian academics to move beyond Achebe, Ngugi, Wole Soyinka, to begin to provide them with materials that would include Olumide Popola's book, or L. Nathan's Born on a Tuesday's book, set in the North. So the curriculum is key for me, because a book might be very pop commercially successful today, but it may not live into the future. Academics, scholars, are the people who allow for engagement of the kinds of things we're going to consume and how books get into the canon. And I want to contribute to that canon formation. And I'm very, very conscious about the production of the canon, right? So when I'm choosing books that we're going to publish and edit, whilst one foot is set in the commercial world, another is set in thinking about the future and what kind of text will get produced into the future. So if we take a book like this, When We Speak of Nothing, When the manuscript came through, it wasn't just because I think this story is interesting. It was what she was doing with language and the ways in which I think many books that have been published by African writers, we don't talk about African literature in terms of their linguistic inventions and the crafting. We talk about them as though they're issues, right? They're talking about the Niger Delta, right. They're talking about the riots. I'm really interested in a text that does that, but also play with the form itself. I'm looking at a text like this that takes you back into the hermeneutics of Yoruba tradition, that's done in English, right? The book opens with Eshua Legbara. This is the if you don't know, this is the trickster god in Yoruba, and it's Yoruba equivalent to Hermes. So this is a hermeneutic. The god of hermeneutics, right? So it opens with it and it closes with it, which is exactly what happens when you think about Yoruba Orishas. If you worship any Orisha in Yoruba culture, you open, even if your Orisha is Oshun, Shango, or whatever, you start with Eshu because it's this translator god, right? So it's really important. So for me, I'm interested in a book that really works with form, but also work with all the different encounters. So you have Yoruba, you have English come into play in this text. So it's that kind, the intersection of those things that I'm interested in. And those are really important when I think about the kinds of book we publish.
Thanks. And since you brought up Ish, which is a really, yeah, maybe I'll just flip the question back to you, Olumide. Like, what informed your choice of, because almost like the narrative voice comes from there.
That's the narrative voice, yeah. And it's exactly that, because Ish can take on any language and it can constantly shape-shift and translate all messages, but it also puts all these obstacles in the way. So you might be thinking, you know, you're flowing along nicely and boom, all of a sudden, it doesn't go forward and there's a problem going on. And why? So that we as humanity, or an individual, but that we as humanity can sort of arrive at the next level. And I like that idea very much. And it fitted the story on so many levels. So Ishu takes on this language of the young youngsters that are who are the protagonists, and he talks in a language, but he also obviously takes on the sort of more local accent when he go to Port Harcourt. But he's also responsible for the problems that are thrown into it, because it's so actually it's a classic issue story. It's two friends, they have no reason to fight, they're super loyal, and then boom, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we have this big problem. And they're on two sides, one is in London, one is in Port Harcourt, and they have to reevaluate their friendship so that they can have a much more adult or grown-up version of it because time, because issue, who knows? So I was just, I was fascinated. I'm fascinated by the stories of the Orishas, and yeah, issue is the first one. So it was the first one you have to speak to. So it's the first full-length novel, so I obviously had to address issue. And it might have been, so full disclosure, because it was part of my PhD research, so it was very research heavy. If I had just maybe written a story, maybe I wouldn't have had so many strands of research, but issue became really the way into the narrative on so many levels. And it was much even more as a PhD project, and then I edited it for make it much more accessible for the final novel.
Yeah. So what discipline is the PhD project?
It was in creative writing. Yeah, I finished.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, it was in creative writing, so I had to I had to present a novel and then a critical thesis to go with it.
Let's hear some more from the novel.
So this is now the end of Carl's trip, and he, for some reason, he has to rush back to London. And Januma, who we just learned about, Januma's cousin, Nakale's best friend, is there for his last night, and Carl wants to tell him something really important, and this is that scene. Home is always holding hands without touching. Are you sleeping? Nakale laughed. Waiting you to do, my friend. You to wash with toothbrush? Carl laughed too. I'm just so tired, Nakale. I needed a minute. I did get time, my friend. No, it doesn't work like that. I get it or pigeon, not both. Why not? Nakale made bloody sense, like usual. Carl was lost in his tracks. Not sure, you're right, I did get you. You could teach me proper London pidgin, oh? For sure, but we don't call it pidgin. When had he become such an annoying smartass? It was dark. There was no electricity. It was beautiful that way, quiet. The neighborhood seemed to be rationing their generator fuel. The thick air lay on Carl's feet, pushing him into the ground. You want me to light a candle? Yes, now. You have to pack your things. Not really much, you know. I can do it in the morning. Carl lay down on the slim mattress. This was almost a reversal. Usually he was the one in the middle of the room, Abu the one at the wall. He had put on his boxers and another T-shirt. It was hard to lie down. His body wanted to be lifted, feet on the cool ground. You did all right. Nakale, all worried, turned towards him, leaning on his side. Yeah, how's the mat? Sorry, it must be so hard, we can swap. Me, I have slept too many nights like this. No be special like for you Europe people. Yeah. Carl was tired of jokes, tired of everything. Nakale? Wait till my brother. Let me just skip ahead. What? The what's of life. Which one? Which one should one convey? All or none? Or stick to the graduations? The gap it was reaching. Nakale, we be friends, right? Yes, now. The heat was like a blanket, a thick one. Maybe it wasn't going to be so bad. If you're enveloped like that, what could happen? What the F could bloody happen? You know, on my papers? Which papers? I mean my passport. Which kind of problem you get for passport? No problem really, but sometimes, Carl, waiting. It never said Carl. There is no Carl, not on my passport. They were quiet. Nakale rolled onto his back and folded his arms behind his head. His face was turned toward Carl. Carl spread his legs a little because it was still warm, but a small breeze had found its way through the window. No need for those thighs to stick together just because of a little sweat. Me, I don't know how to say I'm Carl, yes? For passport, him say you be woman. Now be the thing you want to tell me. There was an abyss again, not a gap. Strike, defeat, no middle part. Nakali shuffled onto his mat and one arm came away from under his head. Carr was looking for the right words that would stop the suction that was pulling him into the thin mattress, through the floor, into the bloody atmosphere, and who the fuck knew if its body would hold, if it would remain in one piece. How do you know? The cook. But how does she know? Maybe she feel I never ask her. She said people pretend that we can know everything by looking and saying there's this side, there's that side. But it can't. It's never like that. When we became friends, she tell me make her better be true friend if I be any friend at all. She said that? Yes. And? I'm waiting. What do you think I mean? I beg. Now you say be problem? Carl's breath was shallow. How great darkness could be. No viewing of his emergency lighting blush. She asked if I be your friend, make I be real friend. And me, I think I am a true friend. He lifted his head, looking at Carl. Carl kept staring at the ceiling. There wasn't anything to see in this darkness, but still, you didn't have to face your friend head on, not all the time anyway. Carl, me, I stay for here. Do you need some more explanation?
Thank you.
And maybe I can say why I really wanted to read this part, even though it's giving sort of things away that sometimes people take some time to notice. And it goes together with issue, but also sort of these stereotypes or these concepts or ideas we have of ourselves and the West and the African continent and how progressive we are about certain issues. And I wanted to reverse some of these things. So when Carl, who's a trans man, goes to Nigeria, he actually encounters a whole lot of possibility. So I'm not saying he encounters a country that is super LGBTQI friendly, it's not that, but he encounters possibilities and layers and cultural layers, and I think that was very important for me. And also in showing that in London there were quite a few issues around that, so because I think we think that we're beyond this sometimes in the West, and we're definitely not.
So that was interesting, because I was wondering that while reading this, I was wondering that, you know, although there, you know, there is this very heteronormative public sphere and some characters have reactions that you might expect to derive from that, there are a lot of characters who don't.
Yeah.
And I wondered, you know, how much is this, and I think you kind of answered it maybe, is how much of this is a reflection of things you've seen, or how much of it is a kind of invoking mm-hmm. of the possibilities that might be within ways of being?
I think it's both, because obviously I also launched the book in Nigeria, and that it was initially, before I went, I say that frankly, quite nerve-wracking, because I was wondering what was going to happen, and it was a fantastic experience, because there was space to discuss these things. Obviously, there's LGBTQ people there, there's organizations working, which I already knew. So it's both. It's an invocation, because also, of course, your imagination is what brings something into being. So if we're not imagining spaces, they will never happen. So it's that, definitely. But also, I think we underestimate the power of the individual, that we're only reading the whole country itself. But of course, there will be people who love you for who you are, regardless where you are. And that has always happened. That's not unique. I think as a country, and definitely in terms of law, there's some things to address for sure.
Bibi, as someone that's involved in, kind of has an overview of these issues, not only through publishing, but also through your other work, mm-hmm. you know, was that always there, or has the conversation changed recently? Have there been kind of like way markers on like where the kind of Nigerian conversation on sexuality and gender is kind of right now? What do you think? Where?
Always there. What period are you thinking about the always? Like, are you talking in terms of contemporary history or historically before?
That's a tricky one, right? So no, let's date it with the Nigerian public sphere, actually, right?
Okay.
Or, you know, since at a point there wasn't a Nigeria, so
yeah.
That's...
Yes, yeah. The Nigerian public sphere. I think that within, there are different moments you can talk about the perception of LGBTQ within the Nigerian public spheres. There's the earlier wave of the Nigerian public spheres, like in the 60s and 50s, where I think there might have been more openness, acceptance, simply because there's probably still a direct relationship still with the Agrarian culture of the society, where they're still very much embedded within a certain Nigerian religious framing that is polytheistic, which then has a certain openness in itself. And then there's the Nigerian public spheres of the advent of a particular kind of Christian, quite pernicious Pentecostalist Christianity that invaded Nigeria. You can call it an invasion that then brought a certain American kind of Pentecostalism in the 70s in particular, which then led to a real non-acceptance of difference and a sense of monotheism of Christianity, of the Abrahamic religion in general, but Christianity in particular, became very much the absoluteness of the truth, of the acceptance of this truth, then manifests itself in every single sphere of life. So it wasn't just sexuality, it was gender. So there was a real closure of the roles of of women, the expressive roles of men, and that meant that sexual differences were not accepted, right? And then you had the moment when Jonathan Goodluck, which I think opened up the Pandora box in Nigeria by legislating, by creating this thing called the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act in 2014. Mm. Yes, 2014. And what that did was, and it was really fascinating and interesting. And in a way, I think when historian comes to write about this moment, it was the transformative moment for Nigeria LGBTQ. Up until that moment, everything was underground. It was there, people carried on their lives and stuff. And people lived in the closet. And then suddenly, there was a law. And the law then led to a certain opening, a defiance. And I think wherever you have oppression, there's going to be resistance. And as a result of that law, it led to more films being made. Suddenly, young people came up at the very same time, platforms promoting LGBTQ films. We sort of thought, okay, since one of the things that Jonathan said was that LGBT, we're going to legislate because they don't even exist. There's no evidence. So, of course, okay, if there's no evidence of queer people, then why are you legislating? Right? But we then thought, so that the next lot of people would not come again and say there are no queer people in Nigeria, let's begin to document. Let's begin to kind of open up that space. And that's what gave birth to Queer Women's Narrative, which is a collection of life stories of queer women in Nigeria. And what has happened since is when we were going to publish this book, our salespeople in Nigeria said, please publish it in the UK for the UK market. For the UK market only. Leave it in the UK because we don't want any headache in Nigeria. And it has been fascinating with the publication of this book. The reception has been incredible. Just amazing, beyond our wildest dreams. This book was published, and lots of people were interested. And I think part of why it was interesting to think about the title, we had a prior title for it, which was called Some Girls Want Wives, which is kind of my ambition, right? every woman wants a wife. Right? This is why men are so lucky. We all want wives to do everything for us. Right? So we changed the title to She Called Me Woman. And we've had really good reception. But what's, for me, the ultimate with the publication of this book was when the Guardian newspaper in Nigeria, the Lifestyle, this is the Guardian, the Sunday paper, and the Lifestyle magazine. One Sunday, we all woke up, and the cover page was the the flag, the rainbow colors. And that was like, we were, all, for all of us in the movement, we were just like, we've arrived. Because Guardian newspaper, the magazine, the Sunday magazine had the rainbow flag. We can go home now. But what it did to a lot of us, it said to us, the thing that we think that cannot be spoken about, there are more people who are actually waiting, who are waiting to be heard and for them to come into force. And there's also more allies than you think. So we have to start the journey and not to say, oh, Nigeria is a conservative society. It is and it isn't. It is both. In the same way that in the UK you have the law. The law protects, but then there's also the lived experience of the law. In Nigeria we have a law and it's in reality as well. So a book like this and other kinds of cultural productions enables a mind change. And this is why I think for people in African studies like you guys, it's politics, law, and all those things. They're fascinating and interesting, but ultimately the thing that really transforms and changes society are cultural output, the cultural work, the work of culture. This is the thing. Publishing is a civilization building. It's about civilization, right? So, it's an exciting moment for us to be able to be part of changing narratives and curating the kind of stories that people are going to consume.
Though in defense of politics and law, right, I would also note that from what you've just said, I can draw the lesson that if you really want Nigerians to push something, ban it.
Yes. yes.
So there's loads more I can bring up that I love in this and stuff, but let's open a conversation out. So what we'll do is we'll take maybe 3-4 questions and then you can both get a chance to answer. So who wants to, David?
Can I just interject quickly just to say that we are still recording, so if anyone asks a question and doesn't want to be recorded, just let us know and we can switch that off.
I really enjoyed the book, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And one of the things that you've been discussing that I was really struck by is language and the kind of rhythm of the language, especially the ways in which kind of London street slang meets hardcore pidgin, which is incredibly evocative, especially of things like Ken Sarawiwa's own Soza Boy, which I guess is one of the first novels really to try and explore pidgin and all broken, rotten English.
Rotten English, yeah.
And it brings me on to a couple of points really related both to him and his output. Soza Boy, of course, is a novel partly set in Port Harcourt. I was just wondering if you had thoughts on the ways in which Port Harcourt as a place is kind of captured and evoked in recent literature. So thinking of Yellow Yellow and Tomorrow Died Yesterday and others. And the other question I had really was about whether you see any trends in that work, and your own, as you said, you're exploring Niger Delta issues, any trends in the ways in which literature has sort of captured the dynamics of protest and politics in relation to oil and the oil industry there in the Delta. How might you see that changing over time?
Let's take a couple more.
I can sort of develop on that one by contrasting what is so interesting for me about your novel to say Fenon Habila's Oil on Water, where the European characters come in at the British woman who's kidnapped, come in to sort of show up how when something happens to a white person, it becomes news. But your novel does something much more complicated, I think, which is to show that everything's connected. So oil, a resource under the earth, that kind of thing.
between, you know, for the connections between London and Wood Harcourt are enmeshed. It's not the one. So maybe that's sort of developing on your question, or beginning to answer it a bit. Sorry, it's not really a question. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make that observation.
I've got a question, I guess, about publishing, or because I'm so, as I understand it, you try to publish in the UK and also publish in Nigeria, and I'm interested in kind of how, to what extent, each publishing in both of those places gives you kind of almost protection against the other one, or allows you to kind of be experimental in ways that you might not if you were just aiming to publish in one, because it sounds like a lot of the works you publish that have got a good reception in Nigeria, you're kind of afraid they wouldn't. But I'm also interested to what extent it kind of does it give you freedom from kind of reception in the UK and the US, or is that still kind of the cultural weight and the economic weight means that really what you do does depend on kind of the favourable reactions here, which obviously you've got. So can you talk more about that?
Cool. Should we take those three for now and then come back around?
I don't know really quite how to start. So I'm going to start with what you sort of mentioned. I think what I wanted, and I think that's maybe what you were sort of commenting about, is sort of reverse a lot of the things. So we have an outsider who comes back to... So we have an outsider from London who goes to Port Harcourt, but his experiences there are not the typical outside experience where it's all about him, and it's usually like sort of the white person goes and then the light will be shine or something. So I was interested in the complexity of it. And again, this has also something to do with issue, where things shape shift. And one of the reasons, for instance, why Carl has such an easy time in Nigeria as a trans person is because he passes. It's very easy. It's not because Nigeria is so great, but because he has a blank slate. And that's really the main factor. So it's only people who are very, very close to him who would know, and that turns out. In terms of where I see the trend in literature going, I have to confess I have done very little reading recently because of that person who's outside and sometimes quite loud, which is my was my really wonderful little daughter. So I don't know where the trend... I couldn't say too much. I'm interested in things that go... In literature goes to the ground, but explores things on a very visceral level. And that's what I'm really interested in. And I think sometimes it has to do with class. And so that's when you were asking your questions and I came up with yours again, I thought, well, maybe this has a lot to do with somebody comes from a really very low working class background and approaches things very different. But I'm also somebody who's lived in so many different places. So when I approach something, I have to access it in a very new way. Where the trends go in terms of, because you started with Kensaro Weaver and language, so I have to answer differently. I can't answer your question particularly, but I'm going to give you some thoughts that I have about what you said, and then you can either be really terribly unhappy or you can ask some more questions. I also know that I have some freedom with language because English is not my first language, and I've, in the last few years, met ton of writers, and I have suspected that I don't have to prove that I speak good English, because already the feat that I write and I wrote a PhD not in my language, I have enough ticks on my thing. So I think there's a freedom that I have that I often don't see, where people come from nice middle class backgrounds who have to sort of prove the mastery of the language, and I prove it differently. I prove it by hearing all these different accents. When I moved to London, I was fascinated by how many different accents there were, and Scots were the most difficult for me to understand in the beginning, but to find a way to put that in. So I don't know if that's an answer in any way. Then the other question was the dynamics of protest in literature, and maybe you have some insights there as well. And again, I thought maybe this has... Because Helen Habila's came from, and that's why class became the unifier between you two. That's also a class issue, because what happens and when we speak of nothing is that they're not hanging out in a middle class area. No, we're going to the marketplace. We're going somewhere else. And that was the interesting thing. So I hope that there is a trend towards that, that we don't have to write in good English, that we can write on the level of, that we can access different languages of the region wherever we're writing in, and that we can get voice to people who are protesting without the outsider. So it being just about the outsider, but trying to find the person living on the ground. That is all I can sort of say to that. I don't know if you have things to add.
I think that with the point about protest in literature, when you said the word protest in literature, I kind of recoil, you know, because I guess from a kind of sociological perspective, you can talk about protest in literature, but when you think about how we read, we don't often read to go to protest. We read because we're, first and foremost, we want to enjoy the narrative, and it's only the protest, the analysis, comes secondary for our academic consumption. Having said that, I think the kind of protest that's going on in African literature today, it's probably, one might call it, more internal and psychic, on a kind of psychic level, where people and the earlier generation, you can couch that what they were doing in terms of the national project, and trying to converse with the West to say, we too are just as good as you. Or they were having a discourse around decolonization and nationalism on a big level, and the younger generation of writers, from what I'm noticing, is they're more engaged with more intimate, everyday lived experience level of looking at the drama of existence, i.e. how people are contesting their relationships, their personal interior world, how they are dealing with, coming to terms with that. You know, so I think maybe that's how I would kind of contextualize the question of protest, in not protest with a capital P, but with a small p. And I feel that kind of more interior, personal way of engaging, of doing politics, is a much more interesting entry point for thinking about how the big political structure is affecting the individual lived experience. To your question about whether having been located in this, I think it's a really interesting question. When I think about publishing, even if people in Nigeria would say, well, this won't work here, and then so you have your sales team in Nigeria who will say, it's not going to work here because of XYZ. And then you have your sales team in the UK who are also concerned about whether this will work in the UK or not, and whether the reception will be there. And so you have the two, and I think it's such a wonderful place to be, and there's Bibi Bakari Yusuf in the middle, who is has to mediate between the two. I think this is the power of the editorial team. And the editorial team then has to be very single-minded, that we are interested in a particular project. Never mind the market. First and foremost, you have to think this. That's for the salespeople. This is what Emma, that's what Emma should be doing. Let Emma sort out the problems that we created. And let Kofo in Nigeria, let her deal with that problem. Let her deal with the fallout. I will be concerned about it. I'll think, okay, let's make concession. Let's change the title. Let's change the cover. But the book will go ahead. The party must continue. And I think it's actually quite good to be able to have that perspective. And that, for me, is a mark of what it means to be a true African in the 21st century, is really to have that double perspective. This is what it means to be us. We're always existing. We're both. And it's a wonderful place to be.
As much as that would be an amazing place to just leave this entire event, I'm going to take another round of questions. If anybody else has...
So you mentioned about the Guardian newspaper.
Yes.
They have a flag there, right?
Yes.
I was quite intrigued as to what the climate is in Nigeria for, in terms of like LGBT and stuff like that. Yes, I was quite intrigued as to how it's moved on or the change, or if it has at all. Yeah.
That's one. Any more for anyone? I have another one I want to wedge in as well, right? While anyone else is thinking still, which is, as well as all the stuff that the book's like purposefully about, one of the things I really like in this, just if it was a book on anything at all, is the sensory nature of it. Mm-hmm. There's stuff that you pick up in it that very few writers about Nigeria pick up. And maybe it's because the characters are these kind of sensitive teenagers who, you know, all personal interactions are freighted with meaning and paranoia and anxiety. I don't know. But the stuff about how people stare at you and how that's just okay to just stare at you. Like, the one thing, like, teenagers in this country never do is look anyone in the face, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, the way people greet and the way... Great description of how people move. Like, just, like, floating down the road, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the speed of movement and all of that embodied stuff.
Yeah.
Is really present in this book in a way that it is in very few other books, you know? It's kind of front stage, but it's quiet, but it's there. And I just wondered if that's, you know, something that you tangibly kind of notice re-encountering every time you kind of are in Nigeria. So that's mine. I don't know if there are any... Yeah.
Thank you so much for this. I just have a question for the two of you. I'm just really interested in what you're reading at the moment.
I'm only laughing because I just told her on the train. So it's a good question.
Cool.
Another one?
Okay.
Is there anyone else? Just a very quick, the power of reading groups and book groups.
Ah, interesting.
If there's, you know, if there's stuff going on with that.
What was the first one that was for you?
Where is the conversation at now?
Oh, LGBTQ.
Post that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I think the conversation is, I won't say because the Guardian newspaper had this thing, things have changed. But things have changed, but things haven't changed. Number one. Number two, I think that the fact that you have a platform like Nasty Boy, does anyone know Nasty Boy? A Nasty Boy? That's, you have a, since this book, since the legislation, you have a Nasty Boy, you have Quito's Diary, you have Where Love is a Crime, there's at least 10 platforms devoted to LGBTQ that didn't exist before. There's, from Tears, for example, there was a web series that I think they're about to go to start another episode, another series, a web series, soap opera, about LGBTQ queer people in Nigeria. And the fact that we're able to have conversations with legislators and they can call us and say, here's what's about to happen. We can go to the police station who before would have just criminalized and what have you. I think there's a sea change going on. The fact that, and interestingly, I think was a few months ago, a whole bunch of young men were arrested and were paraded, which is typical in Nigeria. When they arrest so-called criminals, they will line them up and film them and parade them for public scrutiny. And usually when gay parties are raided, they will parade and there will be a climate of fear amongst the men who are being arrested. But what was very interesting was all these young men were arrested and they were filmed on camera and they kept saying, we know our rights. It's not a crime to be queer, which it isn't a crime. It is not a crime. But because of the fear, so many queer people assume it is a crime, and the police themselves assume that it's a crime. So you're having this group of young men saying, it is not a crime. That's a huge change, right? We can go to the police and say, you need to release people you've charged. And we're not even asking you to bail. We're not even going to pay a bail. We're saying, you need to release, and they do. You know, because there's a renewed confidence. There's a confidence that before, people kind of feel, oh my God, I've been arrested. Hide. That's something to note. And then I just want to say something about the book. What I love about the book, it's so embodied and visceral. I edited it, and every time, you know, sometimes when you encounter a manuscript, you have to decide, can I be with this book for the next 8 months? And with 10 rounds and whatever. And sometimes you think, this is a good book, but I don't know, man. After 2 or 3 edits, I might get bored. So you might not acquire, you might just think, stay back. But this is one text where every time I go to it, I think, gosh, how did I miss that? You know, it was such a beautiful thing to be with for so long. Thank you. It was a very embodied book. I really liked it. What am I reading at the moment? I'm not reading at the moment because I'm editing. I'm in an editorial mode right now, and I will say what I'm editing. I'm editing a book by. It's a collection of satire by one of our authors called L. Nathan John. The book is coming out next year called Becoming Nigeria, A Guide.
That's is that like an update? It's like a counterpart to the How to Be a Nigerian from the 1950s.
Yes, right? Becoming Nigeria. And
God bless his hustle.
It is, yes, God bless his hustle. And I'm really... I'm laughing my head off. I'm just laughing a lot, but also really quite, you know, in between, suffering and smiling. I'm both laughing, but also deeply pained by what's, you know, beneath the satire, beneath the laughter, you're seeing the, is this where we're heading? I hope not. But I'm excited to share the book.
Thanks for the high praise on the book. I think one thing I wanted to say is that actually the book's just about friendship. It's just that the world is also going on while they have to negotiate their friendship. Yes. And another thing that sometimes people get really into is this issue and that issue. Yeah, but that's the world always has lots of issues and lots of wars and all of that. So the backdrop is there. But the thing about the sensory nature and all that, I really wanted to capture how it might be when you arrive for the very first time and how things are so very, very, very... different, and how it's such a sensory overload. And it was difficult for me because I'm so used to going to Lagos, and then to find the differences, and Port Harcourt is slightly different. And I remember I wanted to do it while I was flying there and then ride this car straight on, but I couldn't because in a way I sort of knew what was happening. But of course, even though I know, as soon as those doors open, that heat each time, because you try to imagine you cannot, because when we live in Britain, it's very difficult to know that sort of heavy sort of heat. So it was just that, trying to access all those moments that I remember that and put them in a context of being absolutely new. And then seeing them again. I was always fascinated, that one about the women out there floating down the road. I mean, if you see Nigerian women walk, they can walk so slow and so sensually and so beautiful, but they are absolutely almost not moving, but with such confidence. And it's just one little market girl. You know, she's nobody in any context, but the straightness and the beauty. And I know as a teenager, I have come to Nigeria and lived in Nigeria since I'm 1 year old. So I lived in Nigeria as a very young girl. So I'm used to Nigeria. But as a teenager, when I was fraught with my own, you know, as any teenager usually is, you know, your confidence problems and you feel so ugly and this and that. And you're confronted. I was living in Nigeria as a teenager with these women and girls who are so confident outwardly when they're walking down and they're just almost not moving. So I don't know. That is my favorite scene because I found a way to capture that. So it was just, yeah, finding a way of making that fresh. I just finished reading Christy Watson, Where Women Are King. And the reason I loved, and I think she's British, a writer, but she writes, this is a third or fourth book, but second novel, and it has a Nigerian angle to it. But there was parts that were very, very harrowing because they go around child abuse. And I was telling Bibi about that. It was very difficult because I have a small child, and it was how this woman had been abusing this child, and it was very vivid. So in a way, she's very successful because I still have to close my eyes because it pains me. But I can't heartfully say I recommend it because it's harrowing. When you get there, it's really hard. But there's also hope and joy and love, so that's that. And I'm reading now Lane Castillo, America's Not the Heart, which she is absolutely amazing, and everybody raves about the book. It's very easy to get into, so I recommend it. And I'm writing my next novel, and I'm excited about it. I would say I'm in, I can't say too much, but I'm in, which is always good, because there's a long time when you're just trying to find something to get in, and then watch the space, I guess.
Cool. Well, look, thanks. I think this would probably be a good time to say let's, like, change the mode and probably end the formal bit and have time for some drinks, and you can talk to these guys and buy books and talk about the books and do it a bit more personally. So just to say thanks loads and loads for coming and sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.